Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, embark on a mesmerising journey through time and space with The Night Alphabet, the electrifying debut novel from award-winning poet Joelle Taylor. A dazzling, bold and original work, The Night Alphabet is a deep investigation into human nature and violence against women. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, join Taylor as she delves into the dystopian cityscape of futuristic Hackney in 2233 for a fierce, tender and highly uncomfortable study of power, agency and resilience.
Hello, good afternoon and welcome. I hope that is the event that you're here for. Anyone in the wrong place? Give yourselves a big round of applause for being here on a Saturday afternoon. My name is Jo Bell, and a long time ago when we were babies, people used to occasionally mix us up. We had more similar hair.
Cockney rhyming slang.
Yeah. Jo Bell sounds like Joelle. And people occasionally approached me in public toilets. I mean, that's a whole different story. That's a whole different story. And would say, after a reading, I would say, "You're Joelle Taylor." I'd say, "I wish I bloody was." No. So, since you are here for this event, you probably have a good sense of who Joelle Taylor is. But I'm going to give you a brief summary in a moment for those of you watching in black and white. And I hope that you are storing up questions to ask Joelle as well, because otherwise we'll have that awful British silence where I say, "Are there any questions?" And everyone goes, "Well, there is something I really want to ask, but I'm not going to, for mystery reasons." So please store up really difficult, incisive questions that she can't possibly answer. The way this is going to go is I'm going to introduce Joelle and ask her just a couple of questions to start with. She's going to read a section from her new book, The Night Alphabet, which is, as you would expect, mesmerizing. And then we're going to interrogate her collectively a little bit in the middle, and that's when there'll be space for you. Are you feeling calm?
Excellent.
Yeah? In the middle. So that's when there'll be space for your questions, and then we will have another reading to wrap up. And there will, of course, be an opportunity to get a signed copy outside afterwards, because the people from Waterstones are settling in as we speak. Have you had a good festival so far?
Yeah.
Is anyone here for their first event of the festival? Yeah, good, a handful. Welcome, handful, good. And we're glad you chose us. So I'm going to introduce the force that is Joelle Taylor. And none of this is blagging. This is a great star of our scene. Joelle is one of the great forces in British poetry. A winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize for her book Kunto, a winner of the Polari Prize and the Saboteur Awards, co-curator of the Outspoken Live programme at the South Bank Centre, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and they don't give that away to just anyone. Whatever the world of live and literary poetry has given her in terms of recognition and acclaim, she has always turned right back towards those rising poets who most need support and recognition. As a founder of the UK Slambassadors, working with young people to encourage a new generation of live poets, her impact on poetry culture is a lasting one. And now she's coming for fiction, as we will see. Her dynamic performances have the effect on an audience that the snake charmer has on a snake. That's you. All of Joelle's, oh, they're hissing already. All of Joelle's work, whether pure poetry, stage reading, or now fiction, all of it is an act of witness. It speaks to the experience of lesbians, of working class people, of city dwellers, of those struggling to find their identity, and of those who, having found their identity, lean into it for a deep sense of community and safety. Joelle's success has been a litmus test for our literary culture. The ivory towers have been stormed in recent years by an army of freakishly diverse writers, decolonizing literature and bringing a blast of fresh air into those hallowed corridors. At the front of that vivid army is Joelle Taylor, like Joan of Arc in a tweed suit. A northerner, a Londoner, a writer, a survivor. And now she's bringing the fight to the novel, with her new book, The Night Alphabet. That takes us to a London tattoo parlour 200 years from now and a mysterious client. The Guardian says, it's hard to think of many books more restlessly inventive. It's magical, dystopian, a bit hallucinatory. It's also about the deep comfort of finding your people, about sisterhood and agency, and about claiming the right to live in your own skin without apology. We are profoundly lucky to have her, and especially lucky to welcome her to Bradford this afternoon, Joelle Taylor.
Thank you. Oh, it's...
I actually feel quite cheerful. That was beautiful. That was beautifully written. Thank you.
Oh, you lived it. I just wrote it down.
Amazing.
So we're going to start with just a couple of questions to give you a sense of the person, and then you'll hear from the book, which is a departure in some ways and not in others. And the first question is an accusation. You're originally from the north.
I am.
And then you went south. Have you gone native?
Do you know, I did go native, particularly working with young people for like 20 years. Everyone's like talking like that, bruv, oh, you know what I mean? And then I find myself kind of doing that and then being like, oops, apples and pears. You know, you kind of, I'm from Lancashire. And the reason I came down, there's a couple of reasons. The reason I came to London is A, back in the 80s, that's literally where the work was, if you wanted to beat a feat, if you want to work in arts in any kind of way. And the second is I'm gay, actually. And
no.
I just had to find where was diametrically the furthest place from my parents, from anybody else yeah. who might find out. Like, they wouldn't know.
But they, you know? They're going to know now.
They've died. Yeah, so, but I mean, when I first came to London, I absolutely hated it. But it's that thing you're talking about. London is a huge space, but it's made of villages, of these tiny communities of people who find each other. Very few people who call themselves Londoners are from London. So you get this incredibly diverse, cosmopolitan kind of world. And within it, you create your own ecosystem. You know, and for me, it was the Dyke community in the 80s and 90s. In London, but also through squatting, through feminism. You know, and political activism in various ways.
Where was it in London? What was your parish?
So, I first moved to Brixton because I found a bedsit next to Venus Rising, which was the biggest lesbian nightclub in the world.
Having your cake, etc.
Yeah, literally having my cock and eating it. And I used to go and stand outside. I couldn't afford to go in. And it wasn't creepy. Wasn't Then when I saved up enough dole and I got in, I couldn't drink or anything. I didn't really drink. So I was really creepy.
Yeah.
I just walked around.
See you again.
Hello.
Yeah.
until finally someone was drunk enough to reply.
To let you in.
But yeah.
Fantastic.
And then Hackney's really...
Hackney, yeah. You're right. People speak, don't they, about their parish in London. I'm from Britain or I'm from Hackney or whatever. The other origin story I wanted... comes partly from, I'm running a group of writers and we've been doing a thing this month called the Monogamous Reader, where they commit to one poet for the month. Actually, they've mostly been wildly promiscuous, but some of them have been utterly faithful and a couple of them have committed to spend the month with you and getting inside your head and reading, particularly reading Kunto. And it's been for some of them an education and an eye-opener. And for others, a welcoming into a community and a sisterhood that they wanted to be on the edges of. And I think so much of us as writers, we are formed by our reading very often.
Yeah.
And I wondered, what was in your hinterland of reading at the beginning, or was there nothing that you saw yourself in?
I mean, the very first thing was George Orwell.
Huh.
And what it gave me, because obviously I'm absolutely nothing like him in background, or what it gave me was the idea that you could go through anything if you had a pen and a piece of paper. It's more powerful than a gun. It's more powerful than home, you know. And because I was a kid, 15, I was so impressed by Down and Out in London and Paris that he did that he went and made himself intentionally homeless. And, you know, and so that gave me that spirit of justice that you find within writing.
Activism.
And also the idea of living what you're writing about rather than just academically observing it in a sort of distance way. But the thing that really, really, really made me was the feminist presses of the 80s.
Virago.
You know, Spare Rib, Jesus yeah. Christ. Silver Moon Bookshop. Silver Moon Bookshop, Centerprise. Centerprise.
That sounds like a job.
Sister Rights. these incredible spaces. And I was in Accrington buying like Spare Rib, like it was porn off a top shelf.
Yeah.
You know, again, with my bits of doll, just to find out about who are these women? What are they doing? Yeah. Oh my God, they've all run to a peace camp. I'm going. And it kind of made me, it brought, well, again, it reinforced the idea of the meaning of writing and of that communication, but of community, that there was somewhere that I didn't stand out. I kind of stood in. Mm. You see what I mean? There was somewhere where I would belong. And that got me itching to Greenham Common at like 16 years old to live outside a camp in a carrier bag.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was amazing.
I think that idea of writing as witness to the life and life as a kind of act of witness that backs up the writing, you know, that reciprocal relationship, I see that in everything that I've ever heard you read or perform, that it's about, it comes from deeply from your own lived experience.
Possibly a part of that is about theatre as well. So I didn't have a theatre education because, you know, I wrote my first play and I hadn't really been to the theatre. If at all. I used to read plays in the library, but there was a practitioner called Arto, Antonin Arto. Don't know if you know him. So in theatre, you've got Bertolt Brecht, Stanislavski, who's the naturalist. Brecht is the kind of more physical, out there kind of performer. And Antonin Arto is just a complete weirdo who felt that you had to actually experience suffering if you were talking about it on the stage. So this idea, there is no acting.
Yeah.
There's just remembering, there's just being in that thing. And I think to try to bring that a little bit, well, it's just natural to me.
But I think you do as well. It's missionary work. You know, it's kind of, you know, this is the lived experience.
Mm.
Let's testify. I get a strong sense of that from your writing, as we will hear, even when you're delving deep into fictional things that couldn't possibly really happen in the world that we inhabit. So what I want to know is what made you... What do you mean by being unfaithful to poetry? You know, you've reached for a new form of writing here, and you've talked to me a little bit today about hybrid writing, but what made you reach for something that poetry couldn't do? Why have you reached for a novel?
I've always written, and I've always wanted to write a novel. In fact, I've got a massive one that is absolutely appalling. I will sell to you.
But thanks, I've got one.
It's how you learn, isn't it? You got your own. Excellent. Everybody's got this. So I've always written, and I think what it is certainly it comes from that what you were saying about that idea of being witness, and poetry as witness is a huge part of what I do. But there's a limit. So I wrote a book called Songs My Enemy Taught Me, which is kind of this almost like poetry journalism. So it was quite documentary, looking at how women are treated globally and connecting it to what had been happening to me. And I got so into these stories, but they had to stop because of the pronoun I.
Yeah.
Which is the most powerful. It's like a spear you can pull off a page as a poet. It's really powerful. And you would never get someone, either of us, going on stage, telling a story about a father dying and putting you through that, and at the end saying, well, it didn't actually
only joking.
Actually. Yeah. You know, so it's all got to be real. And I wanted to use imagination more. And you know, I've got into trouble by saying you use more imagination.
Yeah.
But you're allowed to use imagination in a different... You bend the air in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and it allows me to be quite surreal.
Yeah.
In poetry, it's sometimes very difficult, particularly if you're a live performer. You can't really go off on one, as you say.
No, I think...
The audience...
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true, that the expectation, the lyric poetry tradition that we live in, whether it's literary poetry or live poetry or anything, because there's no real distinction, it's bullshit, but it is rooted in me, me, me. It's all me. This is what happened to me. Mm. How does it apply to you? And I think, to inhabit something beyond what you possibly could inhabit, you've gone to fiction, which sounds like a good point, doesn't it, to hear what the hell she's actually written and to hear from this compelling and mesmerising book. So here we are going to have our first extract from The Night Alphabet.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Ah, scattered applause. Amazing. So I've been doing a sort of a live staged reading version, which directed by the amazing Neil Bartlett, and I've done some huge gigs around the country. And I just thought it'd be really lovely to do something that's less curated, if you like. So I'm going to read something I've never read before and just see what happens. And if you give me scattered applause, I will never read it again. So The Night Alphabet, here it is, begins with a character who we find out is called Jones. He's a woman, much older woman, probably in her 70s, running across a 23rd century Hackney. She's running as hard and fast as she can to this distant antiseptic light. And the light is at a tattoo parlour. And inside the tattoo parlour are two women. Jones is already heavily tattooed, like even under her eyelids, under her tongue. Every part of her has got this kind of language across her body. But she's gone to them for one final tattoo. And the tattoo is a line that links all the other tattoos together. And throughout the book, they do this tattoo. Every time they come to an individual tattoo, it's like a door. So you know you say all tattoos have stories. These are kind of different. It's a little bit magic realist, social surrealism, but you enter these separate worlds. So I'm going to read a bit from chapter two, which is a little bit about the beginning of Jones's life when she's 12 years old. And it's from a section called These Infinite Threads. There once was a woman who lived inside another woman. The moment I looked into my mother's face, I recognised her. She was always someone from somewhere else to me, a name I could not quite remember. My father seemed the wrong age too, younger perhaps. It felt like my whole family were wearing each other's clothes. My older brother dreamed of ballet, my younger falling in a lit airplane. I dreamed tomorrow. Things have become more complicated, but that's a simple truth to observe and hold on to. The always. My mother had a face like wet laundry and a laugh that could dig up a field. She raised three children to believe that the ground was exactly where it was supposed to be and the sun a shepherd that would guide us through the days ahead. Pragmatic, practical, but with riptides of surreality. She was the kind of woman who named each knuckle, and she taught me to do the same. Women, she'd say, are fighters, quiet-like, wait until the enemy sleeps. And then that sudden laugh that made all the crockery and pans in the kitchen hold on to each other. At night, she'd tell us stories. There were a few tales of princesses and kingdoms, talking bears and happy penguins for us. My mother favoured Grand Guignol, the chattering decapitated head, the tap at the chamber door, the child who lived in the plumbing. Once, she told me that she kept the skin of her teeth in the top drawer of a dressing table. She'd hung on to it for years, she said. It was her mother's before her. One day, she'd pass it on to me, her only daughter. She named me Jones, after the milkman, she said. Dad said nothing. Fortunately, I had my father's eyes and his way of walking into a room and knocking everything over. After a while, it just seemed like my name. My mother leaked tattoos. They materialised across her body, black ink to tissue paper, a slowly spreading watercolour. The designs were crude, more secrets than artworks. They were, for the most part, indecipherable. Even more so when asked to give an explanation. My mum could suck the story right out of a story. And I often wandered off to examine abandoned rooms in my own head before she'd finished talking. So it was with the shaky blue biro tiger tail that began to edge its way out of the rolled up sleeve of her jumper. I noted it one morning before school, her arms sunk deep into the washing up the boys were supposed to have done the night before. Ineptly etched, still raised and reddening, the tail looped and clung to her forearm. I wondered how far up the arm the tail curled and what was waiting at the other end of it. whether she was holding the tail or it was holding her. Years later, I'd understand there was no difference. "What's new to two, Mum?" I asked, pouring milk that had been out the fridge too long over my cornflakes. She didn't turn round. "It's not a tattoo, Jones. It's a haunting. It's a bloody haunting." Her tattoos were my baby book. They were how I learned to read. I knew she had other tattoos, but we didn't speak of them. They were loud secrets. It was on my 12th birthday that everything changed. My blood had started and I was crouched under my duvet, hating the gods, when my mother backed into the room carrying a cake. "Get down," she shouted, and threw it at me. As chocolate fondant exploded, I, in turn, erupted in a distant land. I watched my hand dislocate from my wrist and fly serenely overhead, my legs dissolve beneath me and my heart shoot from my chest, a slow-motion disassembly. My mouth was dirt and sour, a wet autumn. I thought of Joseph and wondered where he was, whether he'd made it through, if he was still telling jokes through his half-face. My mother stood at the foot of my bed, cake-dripping candle wax, lit and waiting for my breath to enact the next year. My brothers stood beside her, all angles and apologies. For a moment, Joseph haunted her face, my brothers beside her, bones. "I knew you dead," I said. "Right," said my mother, and blew the candles out herself.
Thank you.
I think that almost makes the next question redundant, which is fine, because it's a question that I stole from Joelle anyway. We were in London last night, the night before.
Night before, yeah.
When Joelle was doing a beautiful reading in a tiny bookshop called Pages of Hackney. And she was asking Selena questions, Selena Godden, and she said, "What do you bring to your prose writing from poetry, and what do you return with?" And I thought that was such an elegant question that I would steal it. And so at certain, my first feeling is that when I listen to that, and I've just listened to the exact same passage in the car this morning.
Did you?
Yeah, because I've got the audio book. By the way, you can have this experience all over again by listening to Joelle read to you on the audio book. Is how even in a long piece of writing, it's concise, it's dense, you know, every word earns its keep in this writing. So, but I'll let you answer the question.
So that,
yourself.
I mean, that's a really good
poetry bring? And
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you, with poetry, you learn to distill. But at the same time, you do two things at the same time, so it's a bit, So you learn to distill, but then you wander off and look at the water bottle and talk about it for ages.
Yeah.
Mm. So I bring that, you bring that kind of, that focus, and it can hinder a novel, you know, because, like, so people don't want to read a beautiful sentence all the time.
That's true.
They really fucking don't.
That,
like,
yeah.
Jesus Christ, lads. Yeah. 2 weeks that took, you know. and so you know, it was a much more poetic novel when in the first draft form.
Ah.
And then it went through my agent, who was just like, nope. You know, and there was arguments, because I was like, but that's really good. And she's like, doesn't move the story on.
Yeah.
You have to move the story forward. So I brought, you know, the fact that I love words and the language of words, and probably as well, it fits in the mouth probably better.
The very aural quality, isn't there, to this?
So there is a sense of voice within it, an actual voice, that is. And what I brought back was what my agent taught me, that nothing in my poetry collection should be in there unless it moves the story forward. And that story is at the heart of everything I've always done. Mm. Poetry is story, isn't it? Mm. These kind of incredible moments where somebody will speak 12 lines to you and you are absolutely changed.
Mm.
And and it's like that quote by that quantum physicist, Feynman, who said, if you understand quantum mechanics, then you don't understand.
You don't, yeah.
And it's same with poetry. I'm very suspicious of anyone who goes, a poem is, because you don't know. It just happens to you, you know.
I think you've always had that in whatever you've written, like in Kunto or whatever, the poems, the poetry pieces are always linked together. They're always part of a greater, there's a kind of hinterland of narrative underneath it.
Yeah.
You know?
Because how, Because in poetry, the tradition is, you know, that you'll open a book and you'll stay with the piece. And you close it. No. And then I read Deaf Republic, Ilya Kaminsky. It's a fucking brilliant book. And it's very sparsely written. Mm. It's got so much space in the book, and I'm very dense, you know, there's too much things going on. So that was a really interesting lesson to learn about space. But it was telling a story. I mean, I guess it's not anything new. It's under Milkwood.
Yeah.
You know, you have the device which links.
Play for voices.
Yeah. What do you call it? A plague of voices.
A play for voices. That's what he said.
For voices.
Slay for voices.
A plague of voices.
Yeah, a plague of voices. Plague of voices. Yeah, that too. That too.
Yeah, but the idea of a poetry collection being a page turner fascinates me.
Yeah.
And to be a page turner but not be condemned for it within the poetry community.
And this is interesting because there is a generation of poets now who are moving into different forms of prose. Selena is a case in point, Selena Godden, and who's written Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death, and is now working on another one about life. About life, you know.
The life of life.
What's it about? It's the life
of life.
It's the life of life. I'm writing prose now. Many of the poets we know or that we've come up with are writing longer pieces.
Yes.
Simon Armitage is writing, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not so much to do with us changing, but with publishers recognising us. Because over the years, we've built up this ecosystem, which is, you know, poetry is quite niche, isn't it, really, if you think about it.
It's a minority sport, for
it's
sure.
It's definitely a minority sport.
You mean you're not in it for the money?
I know. Three people in a boiled sweet for 20 years, you know, but like, it's...
We're so excited to see you all.
Really,
in fact, can we have the house lights up a bit? In a minute, I'm gonna demand questions from these good people. So if we could have the lights up in a moment, that'd be good.
That made me laugh. Sorry.
Oh, dear. don't make the author laugh.
Oh, God.
So, but yeah, there certainly is a generation of writers, I think, stretching out their wings in different forms and testing the boundaries between poetry and prose.
Talking to Jay Bernard about it. You know Jay Bernard, who wrote Surge, and I've known for years and years. Yeah. And Jay, I've known since they were 15. And they literally said to me, you seem to be blossoming now.
You're blossoming?
And I was like, I was always blossoming.
Yeah.
There was literally no soil.
Yeah.
Like, there was nowhere to go. And I think once, all you need is a few poets to break through.
And it becomes a tradition.
Yeah. Like, I'm seeing a real tradition at the moment from poetry to prose. And the minute you win a prize, suddenly your memoirs are out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of really positive for us because it gives us all these different adventures, these different avenues to explore.
Yes, and I think it's a one-way system. I think we are allowed those adventures. I don't think many prose writers come into poetry. I mean, to be
we're
fair,
really horrible.
Why would you? There's nothing there for them. But yeah, listening to your language, though, I'm struck with that. Whether the all of those beautiful turns of phrase, like the chiasmus of whether the tail was holding her or she was holding it, you know, that tattoo, that's a poetry technique. That's I think it's called chiasmus. Michael Donaghy used to do it all the time, and those rhetorical or literary tricks harnessed to a story, it's fantastic. And what also strikes me, before we come over to your question, so I hope you've got thousands of questions tucked up your sleeves, is that this is a different way for people to experience your work, because most of what you do has a theatrical element. It's been on stage, you're performing it live. The full dimension of any of Joelle's books is hearing Joelle's voice, is seeing her inhabit it. And for me, the books are a record of it, rather than a substitute for it. Perhaps other people experience it differently. But a novel is a much more private experience for the reader. If they don't know your voice already, they aren't necessarily going to hear it
exactly.
in exactly the same way.
So it's compelling, the idea that I don't need to be in a room with someone.
Yeah.
And it's frightening. It's one of the reasons that I tried to do, well, I didn't even try it. So we launched in Queen Elizabeth Hall, which is a 900-seater.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. And Russell Tovey agreed to be the person, no, that person, the person who talks to
this
me.
This person. The interrogator.
That's it. I met, and he was fucking brilliant. Because I made it into a gay club for absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with gay clubs at all. I was like, come on, that's what it's going to be.
Because you
and
can.
And so he came dancing onto the stage, and it was like 700 lesbians screaming over Russell Tovey. Something I'll never forget. But part of the reason of doing that is that the discomfort I have, like,
of letting go.
If I could follow everybody who buys the book home, yeah, just sit there going, what do you think?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you read that right, though?
Yeah.
Did you read it right? Could you just read it again? Okay, now read it like this. You know, so, you know, it's so it's the staged live version. And also, the other thing is, you get addicted to standing on stage and doing a piece that has, it's finite. And the audience gets to experience the beginning, the middle, and the end. And in a novel, you don't get that.
Yeah.
And I've been to so many novel readings where you're like, and? Yeah. And so Neil Bartlett, an absolute genius, just kind of went through the whole novel and constructed. I mean, I edited it first and they just put a red pen through it.
Yeah.
And okay. So, no, you're telling people too much. Don't tell them things. Don't tell them everything.
Which is the lesson that as poets, and I'm sure, that, you know, it's an event with writers, half of you are going to be poets at least. Yeah. The lesson that we tell ourselves again and again and again is show, don't tell. We never bloody learn it.
Yeah.
We never learn it. We still do it over and over
yes.
again. Yeah.
Show, don't
yeah,
tell.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there's that private thing. And I think, doesn't that mean it also has a different kind of longevity, that it belongs to the reader in a different way?
I think so. It belongs to me much less when I think about it. You know what it's like? You release a book and then it goes. But with your poetry, you can always have it and stand with it. You know, and
because it's you, that thing that you were speaking about of the I is central. That yeah. So the poetry is your story, whereas this is a story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a story. And I'm also, they've asked me to do a second, well, three.
Because
just to explain, it's the story of three women. Grandmother, mother, and a daughter. Ooh. So I'm going to do the mother's story next. And then finally, we find out what's going on in the third novel.
Fantastic.
Fuck knows.
Fantastic. Fantastic. This reminds me also of Rosie Lugosi, who is yes. now our friend Rosie Garland, who yeah. also is writing, is moving over from yeah, someone. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Right. Okay. At this point, ladies and gentlemen, we'll go over to the audience for some questions, including the person who's just booing me from the front row because I'm stealing her question. Do you have a question? I'll repeat them back, by the way.
It's so brilliant. It's just really great.
Through Rosie Garland.
Yes.
And we did, just after lockdown, a queer poetry session. Each month for 6 months. And so I came to your poetry that way. And I'm friends with Rosie. She's been to my little bookshop in Haworth a couple of times. Yes. And she's written novels and she performs them like you do, because she's a performance poet, as you are.
Yeah.
And she reads the novels the same way. But the question is, why did you go to poetry first and not to be a novelist first? Because you told us about being in London, but you didn't say what brought you to poetry.
Yeah, true. So, like, well, I've always written, and actually what I wanted to be was a playwright. I really wanted to, and I from a very working class background, it was very hard for me to get into a university, and it was a big, big deal. And I did a 4-year degree. So the final year is kind of like a master's, except they didn't give us the award. You just did, you know. And so I was obsessed with being a playwright, but like I said, I didn't have enough experience of theatre. I didn't get to see it. Everyone I was on the course with were all very middle class. No, I'm going to see this. And they saw loads and loads of stuff. And then eventually I put on, I formed a theatre company called Spinster, if you remember, Sue. Spinster with Vanessa Lee. And then we do these, what are actually spoken word theatre, physical theatre pieces. And then I split them up afterwards. It takes so long to raise money for theatre and to get everything together and to do it. And it was a lot quicker back then, but than it is now. And so what I did to survive was recognise the really poetic bits, and make them poems, and then go on stage. So you're constantly standing with your work. It's a way of eating, literally. And even if you didn't get paid, somebody buy you a pint, do you know what I mean? And you make connections and make community. And then once you've seen enough people, then you... I was like right at the beginning, I guess in the 80s, seeing John Cooper Clarke, who I'm nothing like. And, you know, who else? Jules.
Who did Von Tattooed.
Jules was a massive influence on me as a kid.
Yeah.
Because she had amazing hair, and so did I. I literally copied her.
She's now a tattoo artist. I can show you in a little while.
I've seen some of her. Jules Denby.
Jules Denby. And also a novelist now, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And fantastic. So seeing Jules do that work, and obviously we all wanted to be rock stars as well. And like if you were a bit shit at music, you know.
Rosie is a rock star, of course.
Literal March Violet.
A literal rock star who's just been touring Europe with her band, the March Violet. Yes, yes. She's supposed to be on a writing retreat with me. We all know each other, you know. she's going off on tour instead to be famous. So, yeah, that's great. Have we stopped frustrating you now? Okay, because that was fizzing out of you, wasn't it? Let's have some more questions. Who else wants to ask something? Gentleman next to you.
Thanks very much. It's been great so far. How has what inspires you to write changed over time?
Oh, very good.
Uh-huh.
It hasn't.
Next question.
I mean, I was about to say it's a really good question because I can see very different periods in my writing and different preoccupations, but it always goes back to injustice. It's the same thing. And injustice doesn't actually, it is politically based. All it comes from is naivety and this child constantly being shocked, constantly disappointed by people around me. I was sexually abused as a kid as well, and that's one thing. By the age of five, before you can write, you know something about people. You know something that your adults don't know. Then that's at the heart of everything I write, is why. That's it. It's a kind of curiosity around why. And that relates to young people. I did a lot of writing when I was doing Slam Ambassadors around the young people I worked with and my own experiences of being working class. But it's always been a preoccupation around being a woman or female and what that means. And only, I remember very, very clearly when I got to Kanto thing, well, I've done working class now. And I've done young people. What else is there? Oh, I'm gay. Let's do that. It's the gay one. Next will be about people with very.
What comes things. Next? Tweed.
Tweed.
The Tweed collection.
Oh, I like that.
Diary of an Edwardian country that's been done already.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, but that's it. I mean, when you unpeel why we all write, I think somebody very famous said we all write about the same thing for the rest of our lives, and we do. We just find different ways of getting closer to it. You know, or different perspectives, different ways of looking at it, but it's the same poem, it's the same story all of our lives.
Yeah, we write. I write about dirty sailors. Yeah, I've written the same book over and over again about inappropriate relationships with people on boats. That's my whole life story. So I just keep
before you even lived on a boat.
Exactly. Yeah, literally before I even lived on a boat. Yeah, but I think a lot of the time in writing of any kind, what we're saying is, I think the world is like this. Do you think the world is like that?
Yeah.
And testing a model of what the world is like?
Yeah, and also the sense of reaching out. You know, you mentioned community being whole.
Yeah.
Because I felt very exiled as a kid, like I was alluded to through the whole gay thing. Like we had to leave these spaces during that period in time. And that wasn't just me. It was very common that young dykes and queers, we all legged it. Because there was nowhere we could be. And then we found each other. And you know, that relates to the spare rib as well, and to these feminist and women's presses and queer presses, gay presses of the 80s and 90s. It's a book, it's how we belong.
That sense of being a subset within a subset,
yeah.
I think is really strong. Mm. But, and you speak in Kunta about how no one wants a butch lesbian, even the lesbians don't want a butch
lesbian.
Yeah,
and it goes even further. So butch is a very working class identity. And I remember talking about the A gays. I just got an award, actually.
Don't tell us.
What I'm saying is I'm literally bitching. But Diva magazine,
yes.
I would describe as the A gays. So when it first founded, they were the gays that were more corporate. They had money.
They like the proper gays.
They had houses, whether they were renting or had mortgages. But we were like...
Are they the Bloomsbury set?
Literally. Kind of... I mean, not that bad, but they're very different to me and my sisters squatting in Hackney or, you know, outside Greenham Common, doing loads of drugs, drinking all night, you know, everyone's gone quiet now. That was just my life then.
No, that energy and excitement is in everything.
But I just got given an award by them.
Fantastic.
Which was it?
Fantastic.
You know, it was amazing. Like, Sue Frim is looking shocked. Wait till I show you. Like, it was an amazing thing. But we were, I used to say, even the queers think we're queer.
Yeah.
Because we were the very underclass kind
queerer
of
than
community.
Queer. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Come on. Who had their hand up towards the back? Oh, okay, fire away, sorry.
I was wondering how much of a plan or outline you had in your head of where the story was going to go when you started, or how much you just sat down and wrote.
I'm a big believer in chaos. We all come from it. That's what sex is, isn't it? Well, mine is. So I knew I wanted linked stories. I knew I wanted to... Because also migrating from poetry to prose means, you know, I wanted to learn a new thing. So I just knew I wanted to write these stories about these different women. I knew it was related, the holding device was tattoos, but I didn't know. Have you read the book? Okay, so there's a big story going through it, but you don't realise until the end. And that's really why we're going on to the next novel. So it's all, so basically, no. I started it, then I knew it needed to be called The Night Alphabet because I'd just had this story developing, which is the very first story I wrote, and it's a very sad story. And then I needed a reason. So then it became like a crossword puzzle, trying to figure out what I was talking about. And it's a book about infinity, but how that's expressed through the female form. And I could get really boring about this. So once I had that idea, and then I understood that, you know, like this shape here of our hips, the lady bits, is a lemniscate, which is the symbol for infinity, isn't it? So that's what started me thinking about how what the bigger story was. Then I started to plan it and pull it all together. And then I had a real eureka moment, but very close to the end. And I like writing things where I don't know what's going to happen. Mm. Because you know when you do know, when you really plan, it becomes labour. It's no discovery, is there? It's like sight.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you write it like that, you write in chaos and find out what you mean. Yeah. And then you get to that weird stage where you're like, well, I'm stuck, but I can't change it because it's clearly what happened. And then you're like, yeah. No, you made it up.
She would never do that.
You write it, dickhead.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of... Paint yourself into corners.
She'll do whatever I tell her to do, actually. Yeah.
So the hardest bit was the beginning. I rewrote it so many times. Yeah. I hate the beginning. I love the beginning. It's a brilliant book.
And where can we buy it, Joel? Why, in the lobby.
Right, in the lobby, young man.
brilliant, thank you. We've got time for a couple more questions before we hear from Joel again. We've got someone. Right, let's make this... Poor person with the microphone, run up to the top.
The riot team. Yeah,
got a T-shirt on that says riot. We'll do that after the event. Riot. Right. Fire away.
I forgot you were talking about me then. Thank you. So it's just a quick question. Like, the tattoos are such a central theme to the book, and like wrapping it all together. Do you have any tattoos?
I do.
You can tell, don't show.
Yeah. Am I wearing? Oh, I can actually.
What am I wearing?
So this was the very first one. It was very embarrassing. So I had just done my first play. I was like 26 years old and I got paid 30 quid for 6 months' work. Cheers, lads. So I wanted a tattoo, and they were very, very, very rare back in 1994. It was only sort of criminals and gay people who had them. And what was really popular?
And which one were you?
So it's a very, you know, I talk about it in the Night Alphabet as well, the link between the criminal underworld and the twilight world of the homosexuals, very close. Anyway, at the time, angels were really, really popular as a symbol for the LGBT community. It was little angels. So I went to get a little tiny one, but I was so shy and little. And she said, it needs to be bigger. And I was like, okay. I didn't want to do it, but I felt like really shy. I wanted to look cool. And I said, just please don't, and I put a knob on it. Like, I don't want to walk. She was like, I got you. I got you. Don't worry about it. And then she did it. And then it's amazing. She put a fanny on it.
Oh!
35 years walking around with a hat in my arm. I was like, and this one is a poem by Patience Agbabi, who I worked with in a, we were in a band together called Atomic Lip back in the day in the 90s.
Did not know that.
And she got a residency at a tattoo,
tattoo parlor. Yeah, she
yeah, and phoned me to, can we please get a tattoo?
Oh.
Because the press are coming and someone wants to.
Fantastic.
And then this is a three-line Sakyan, which I talk about in the book. And I am going to get more, so I want to do a show where I'm being, I'm going to do a reading in a minute from a section, and I want the tattoo, which is an anchor and a nautical star, tattooed on me while I read the story. It's going to hurt, isn't it?
Mm.
Maybe, okay, new idea. I read, you get the tattoo.
Yeah, you'll have tattoo artists queuing up to collaborate. Brilliant. I think we've got time for one more before we hand over. Have I right? This person.
Oh,
No, we'll come back. We'll come back.
I have the mic. I'll burn ahead.
Yeah,
just listening to you, I come across a couple of terms, exile and migration. And my question is, because you mentioned as a child you felt like you were an exile, because of the person you felt you are going to be or you were, and as you were going through life and you discover in yourself an identity. And you mentioned that you migrated from poetry to novel. The couple of terms you mentioned, which led me to this question to ask, writing poetry, has it been giving body to that internal conversation you have with you as a person? And writing on the piece of paper for you to see it in front of your eyes, to kind of give it eternity? Or was it just sharing who you are with the bigger audience? Because I think as a poet myself, I think we as an artist, as poet, whatever shape and form of art you are involved with, the difference is you have that internal conversation and we tend to give it body.
That I think
to have it before your eyes.
Contextualized it, I think you're right. I think, and the way you've picked up on terms like migratory and exile, I think you're right. I think it's about giving body. You know, we talk about in poetry a lot about finding your voice, and it doesn't just apply to people who embody poetry on stage, who perform it in some way, but it's the voice within the work. So you can pick up a Joe Bell and know who it is. Like if you heard Beyonce, you'd know who it was without seeing them. They have a voice, so it's very strong.
Their royalties are better.
So it takes years to get your voice. And at first you're impersonating people who have voices. You know, you're kind of ventriloquist for every other poet who's popular on the scene. But as I've got older, there is that sense of, oh, I had an image in my head then, it was really creepy. It's like you're writing little kind of dolls, your audience, you're kind of, the poem becomes these bodies in the room that you share. That's really creepy. But yeah, to embody it, for it to be real, for you to hold your life in your hand is a very powerful thing. And if you're always in these liminal spaces, if you're in these transitory or liminal spaces where you're moving between things all the time, or that sense of being pushed out of a community, then to have that is really important. It's a packed suitcase. You know, it's a home, it's a place where you live.
We are going to have one more because you've been so patient waiting for us to come to your question. So we will make you run a little bit more,
I'm afraid.
Right down to the front, yes. Yeah, more tattoos here. So we'll have a last question and then we'll hear from Joanne.
I was just wondering, because you were saying about writing poetry, like sort of having the I pronoun, and a lot of it's you write it sort of like about yourself, yeah, for yourself, and then people flock to it. Did you find it weird then, like, were you aware that you were writing for other people when you started writing prose?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's not your own experience. But then I was talking to someone else about this. It doesn't matter what we write, we're literally writing about ourselves. We're trapped. So I might call myself Vera. Do you know what I mean? What we all know is me. And you kind of imagine how somebody else would respond in that. You get to be imaginative with what it means. What someone does, what it means, and how the world building is amazing. It's a really joyful part of it. What was the question again?
Did you feel like, so when you were writing prose, did you have in your head that you were writing it for other people to read,
yeah,
whereas poetry is like you write it and then people just happen to read it and relate to it?
Do you know, I kind of just wrote the stories, but as the process went on, and that's where other people come in, you know, like your agent or publisher, your editor. And then you're like, oh, yeah, it's not me, is it?
It's not just me.
Awkward. Yeah. I mean, but I'm trying to think if I made that decision. In Canto and other poems, I wrote that entire book for straight people because I was really angry. And that's why there's a glossary. And then it became really big. Gay people. Gay.
Yeah.
You know? No, but I mean, it controversially became a success, much more with LGBT people. So it's kind of, I'm becoming more conscious of the reader, shall we say that. For most of my life, my readership has been at like a room like this with 100, 200 people, a little bit drunk. Or is it me?
Lunchtime, mate. Are you drunk? No. Oh my God, they're sober. If only we'd known. Right, we're gonna stop with the questions and we're gonna return to Joelle in a moment. So when she's finished, there's gonna be an opportunity to buy the book outside, which I hope you will, and have a chat with her and get her to sign it. But for now, please let's thank Joelle for returning to the stage.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So I'm gonna read an extract carefully curated by Neil Bartlett, from a story called O Maryville, they're interconnected stories, not exactly stories. And I want to do this because I wrote this in something like 2019 and it became Canto and Other Poems. O Maryville. The first time I died, it was like falling into a mouth. The second time I died, it was like walking through a door to find a door. The third time I died, it was into a small toilet cubicle with a cracked toilet lid. From beyond the stall, I could hear a Boys Town Gang CD unbutton its shirt and the swallow flight of voices caught in murmuration. I opened the cubicle to a short queue of women waiting to use it. I nodded to them. No rush, the first woman said, a hole in the center of her chest. If I put my eye to it, I could have seen through to who she would have been. Take your time, she said. The other women were equally wounded, though most not so obviously. Where am I? Home, she said, such as it is. Welcome to the Maryville. I stepped into the bar and straight back into my body. I found myself sat at my usual stool, breastfeeding a Sailor Jerry while I watched a flicker of women nestle into themselves around me, all the ghosts returning, all of us alive again. The mirror behind the bar threw a face I once knew, and it stuck. While I didn't recognise all the women, I knew they were my people, familiar strangers, and I knew where I was. Maryville was the old bar I spent most of my adulthood living out of in East London, the kind of bar that only really opened when it was closed. I sipped my drink and played with the loose end of a smile. It was, I thought, I deserved justice that I should spend the afterlife at a lock-in in my local dive bar. The bartender was a handsome black stud, hair shaven into a crystal ball, body shining in black leather. A dog tag winked from her neck. The ghost of Gautier clung to her wrists. She refueled my drink and paused. It's you, innit? I looked more closely at her. Valentine, I said. Jesus, I said. Yeah, that's right. Good to see you again. How have you? Valentine and I looked around us at the women materialising at tables or bent over a pool shop, stood one arm resting against the countertop or mid-walk to the dance floor. Each hung tattoos from their bodies as though they were galleries. left-handed sketches of sailors and swallows swooping across collarbones, cartoon hearts, the weight of hand grenades, La Vida Loca, angels pulling their smiles back like bows, gravestones marking the spots where dead names were buried, crucifixes and Celtic bands, pink triangles and three-line sack yants, sewing our skins together, brands and scars still curling, still alive. Maryville was a place where women learned to wrong walk together, arms hooked over shoulders, heavy as first love, tender as fists. We were our own big brothers, dressing in the suits we saw our fathers leave in. We taught each other the right words for words. We taught each other our faces, plucked long hairs from collars. We mothered the male in us. When I was alive, I made my way to the Maryville every night, and I knew just about everybody, either by name or face or idea. But I had three close friends. We were a knuckle of butches who laughed together, fell in love inappropriately, shouted when we spoke, pushed each other and lent each other our combs, checked each other. Are you here? Did it hurt? Oh, my ugly loves. Oh, my handsomes. Remember when our faces used to hide behind us? We were one. Dudzilly, a tall Ghanaian butch who kept her hair in neat dreadlocks shaved at the sides, stretched over the pool table, scattering balls like gossip. Her laugh, wild birds escaping the cave of her mouth. She was my best boy. Two, Valentine, behind the bar, smooth as compliments, alive with her ideas, her face a reflection in every femme's pint. Three, Angel, walking out of the toilet, brushing her nose. Skinny with life, a young boy, eyes jumping to meet every girl who walked in, her body in constant movement as though tectonic plates were shifting beneath her skin. She moved most when she was still. And four, me, Jack Catch. The four of us navigated the night, steering the bar through rough waters and across flash floods of opposing thought. We were different suits, same fabric roll. We noticed Angel straight away at the Maryville club night. A whole river of young butches and studs streamed into the bar, each one more pompous and beautiful than the one before. Angel was wearing camouflage pants and a white tank top, her hair shaven so close to her skull it looked as though it was trying to get in. It was a Friday, and Angel was packing a wasp nest, a real stinger of a cock, stuffed into her tight and white. Sorry for laughing. Duds caught my eye and I threw it back. These younger butches, man, were a frivolous mystery to us. All show tunes and knuckle dusters, spittle and glitter. Angel was so serious, she sucked the laugh right out of the room. Without warning, I felt a gentleness I didn't know I possessed. I wrapped my arm around her neck and kissed the up of her cheek. She twisted round, grabbed my face between her palms, her eyes dancing with coke light, and kissed me full on the mouth. Fuck you, I laughed, and the night tore off its dress. And Valentine. Valentine joined us one night when the four of us squeezed cheek to ass in a tiny wobbling toilet cubicle, each taking turns to dip down to the lid for a little sharpener. We were a cloud of hummingbirds, all proboscis and natter. The lines spread across the lid, white against white, like a pretend family tree. When we stepped out the cubicle, it was into a friendship as tight as a fist, as a shaven cunt. The bar used to get attacked. It happened more frequently than was supposed, but then there was the night of the great resistance. It began when Angel was minding the door. It'd been a busy night, and all the crew were there. Earlier, I'd spent my time in the toilet queue with a group of younger butchers. All of us turned toward the mirror in a gesture we were each estranged from. But that night, we turned and we beheld ourselves. Our suited glory, our tight shaven hair, our direct gazes, the way we touched our own faces. When the men came, Angel said they stood there, faces as wide as Saturday, best shirts, hats tucked beneath their arms as if they were newborns. When the men came, they were polite. There were three of them, white boys with grey mouths, choir boys concealing blades in their steepled palms. Angel was firm. "Ladies' night," she said. "Oh, come on, bruv, just wondering." "Oh, come on." When a woman says no, it's an act of violence. They pushed forward. An Angel fell against the takings tin, scattering silver shrapnel across the floor. I was in my usual place at the bar when a 20 pence piece snapped against my shoe. I bent to pick it up and followed the trail to the door. Angel lay on her back, legs still pushing against the corner boys. The music forgot itself. Couples sprang apart as though the boys' presence had reversed the magnetic poles. We all moved 3 inches further away from each other, further away from ourselves. And the men drank it all in like lager in a hot city summer. Valentine and Duds ran with me to the door, and the four of us pushed back at them. Maybe this is what they mean by dyke. We're always shoring up the banks, one finger raised against the flood, a small girl shouting back at a tsunami. Behind us, youngers and femmes formed a tidal break. We pushed a reverse birth. The men yelled and fell back to the pavement, and in one movement, Angel snapped the bolt tight against the door. When it slid into place, Maryville roared, and our roar was legion. Our roar contained the stubbed voices of our childhood, of every girl who'd stood her ground until she became the ground. The jukebox was hungry, and we fed it. We talked, called for beer, rolled up our sleeves, and asked the girls to sterilize their brooch pins. We were tattooed in the lazy yellow of the late night in the sepia tint of belonging. Valentine took charge of it and laid our forearms thin skin up along the bar top. She moved along as like an overseer on a factory line. She fixed us. She fixed the skin to the bone to one another, to the bar, the idea of it. And it felt as though my blood were joining with the blood of the other women, with Angel and Valentine and dear Dud Zilly, all of us blood butchers. That night, the tattoo was a reclamation, a flag we mounted in the center of our own landscape, our veins a map of escape routes across the city. Day four, we eroticized difference. We did not. We eroticized survival. The truth is, we were tattooed before we were tattooed. The knocking made us the same blood. We collected bruises like stamps and posted them to one another. We talked with women we'd only nodded to before, saw others for the first time. The story started, and where they ended, we began, bathed in the warm light of beer and women and the clink of tongues, the avalanche of chatter. We stayed that way, drinking, talking, and soothing until dawn.
The corner boys were waiting for us. They must have been standing there all night, listening to us laugh, and the love they heard must have sounded like rain. They wanted us to stop. One black woman takes up as much space as 100 white men, and they needed to breathe, to get some air amid all the air. Valentine went down hard, and we were all old-faced, bodies swinging to face the boys, and I was beer, and I was fury, pushing the boys back from us. Behind me, I heard Dodds groan, and Valentine swear. Angel stood beside me, tingling. We'd forgotten our breath. I had the clothes, but not the body, not the energy required to absorb and return punches with full-grown men. My murderer concealed a small paring knife in his fist, all the better to whittle me into the shape of a woman. Irrespective of my suit, I was a small girl in a thin cotton nightie on a wet street, my fists bright red balloons on the end of strings. I was inevitable. I took the punch with me all the way to heaven. I fell into myself and I couldn't climb out again. The body let go of its promise. The mouth let go of its apology. The hands let go of the war. And the body of the dead woman was my mother in my father's suit. I felt Dodds pull my shirt open as if she'd be able to find me living in there somewhere. Her bellow was the sound of an antelope roaring. There was a moment when I was both dead and alive. A thought experiment spread across the night pavement. A woman stood slightly to the left of herself. I looked down at my body and I understood motherhood. I marveled how anyone could have found my living face masculine, how soft it was. How girl. I waited by my body until the police came. Stood vigil until the unlit ambulance. As I stepped away from my body, I turned. They were all there, waiting for me, smiling. Everyone I had ever loved. Angel laughed and fled her skin, her eyes fixed on something I couldn't see. Valentine kicked her corpse and moved toward a crowd of femmes, her hands passing through them gently. And Dudzili, brave, relentless Dudzili, stared directly in my eye. The pupil of her eye brightened and broadened until it became a white tunnel. Alive with possibility, with longing. I lit my cigarette and slowly walked into it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.